Hello and welcome to the Microsoft Data Center vNext Preview, bringing Azure to your data center. Hopefully you've seen some of the new announcements we've made in the Ignite keynote around Windows Server, System Center, and the all-new Azure Stack. In this session, we're going to delve one level deeper and explore some of the key capabilities in the area of compute. I'm Matt McSpirit, Technical Evangelist, and I'm pleased to be joined by Matthew, who's a Group Manager in the Data Center Compute team. Matthew, let me ask you some questions about our strategy and what we're doing in this space. But firstly, tell me about some of the challenges that our customers face within their data center and some of the questions they're asking of their own environment going forward.
Thanks, Matt. Let me walk you through the slides first. There's one slide which talks about all these questions. There are primarily three big questions that people come and ask anytime they talk about data centers, and roughly they are, how do I run my mission critical applications? Is my platform ready to run them? The other big question that's come up is around security and assurance, saying, can I trust my data to not leak out? And there's been enough incidents of that happening. And then finally, where's the future? There's a lot of talk about how do I build my next generation applications and what's Microsoft doing to help me get there? So that's roughly how I would categorize the three big areas of investments for Microsoft as well.
So if we just explore those in a little bit more depth, what is a mission critical app? People aren't familiar. What constitutes that?
So you can argue that a mission critical app is any application that's really the core backbone thing about your application. Your business relies on that.
So it might be your CRM application, it might be SharePoint, it might
be
an email application, something that's really powering the business.
Yes, absolutely. So the reason why I wanted to call that out is there is this expectation that applications have to be big and perf hungry and so on and so forth, but that's not necessarily the case. There are different attributes that matter to mission-critical applications. Now, a lot of mission-critical applications, such as large databases, do require a lot of perf, a lot of high availability attributes, but that's not necessarily the key. But they all contribute to what is a mission-critical application.
Okay, and we'll explore some of the key features and functionality of the next release of Windows Server and System Center that enable customers to effectively run a platform that provides those and meets those needs of the mission-critical apps. But you mentioned security. Are we just talking about network security? We're talking firewalls? I mean, what constitutes security in the environment in the data center?
Yeah, so this is one of the most passionate things that I have, things where I feel like Microsoft has done an awesome job in understanding what the real problem here is. So let me try to explain it in a scenario kind of a form. What does security really mean? In the simplest form, it's about if I, as an application owner working for a company, have some sensitive information, how do I ensure that that application or that data never leaves my confinement? So I know who should have access to that information, and I give access controls and so on and so forth. But in this new world with virtualization and the cloud, we have hit an issue where the application or the data-based data for that application is actually available for easy access to the virtualization administrators, to the operators of the cloud. And that's created a big issue for most companies, people who want to protect their data. This core problem is what Microsoft is trying to solve, which is how do I prevent my administrator, if I'm the hoster, whether it's my local private hoster or the public hoster, how do I prevent my administrator from accessing my tenant's information? Okay. And what can Microsoft do to solve that?
All right, we'll explore that a bit later on. And the final area you talked about was around applications. Now, I think there's a lot of organizations out there who are still thinking about how they support their existing applications. So traditional stuff that may run on Windows or Linux, it may be running a traditional workload like Exchange or SQL Server or SharePoint. But when we talk about the new types of applications, do you have an example of one that's, without going into too much depth, because we'll talk about it later, but what's an example of a new type of app?
The new applications are written mainly for the cloud. they're written as a scale-out applications. They start out with very simple tool sets, use as much open source or available platforms as possible, but they are primarily written as a scale-out application. They have certain attributes such as fast startup time, easy to deploy, easy to iterate over and modify. And so this is the age of the new DevOps model, where the developer and the operations person work very closely hand in hand and provide capabilities at a much faster iteration. Mm.
Okay, we'll explore that a bit later on as well. So before we dive into looking at how, with our technology in the Microsoft data center space, how we start to address some of these, tell us a little bit more about Microsoft's overall strategy towards the data center and how we learn from Azure, as an example.
Microsoft is one of those, well, probably the only company that has this unique position where we own both the public data center, super large properties that Microsoft owns, offering services to its customers, and we have a leadership position in our server virtualization market, where our customers are deploying servers and Hyper-V on their private cloud or even the virtualization platform. Our go-forward strategy is actually to bridge the gap. This is what we keep hearing from our customers. They want Azure on their private cloud, and we are enabling that. We want to make sure that the experience that either IT administrators or developers in their organizations have a seamless experience, whether they are building their applications or deploying to Azure or to their local infrastructure.
Okay. So when we think about that Azure influence, it's obviously helping to influence what we bring to on-premises for our customers, and they can benefit. And that's hence the title of the course, is bringing Azure to your data center, helping you benefit from those key capabilities. But if we circle back to specifically focusing on that mission critical app, I want to understand a little bit more about what is it in our platform within Windows Server and Hyper-V that enables you to run those big workloads, those SQL servers, those big SAP implementations and Oracle workloads. What is the kind of scalability that people can expect now in Hyper-V?
So starting with Windows Server 2012, that's when we made this big push towards making sure that no app or no workload is left behind. So we made a massive push to support the largest possible VM that's needed for most of the applications. Close to 99.5% of the applications out there should be able to run virtualized. And towards that end, we created the ability to support super large VMs, whether it's 64 virtual processor VMs with 1 terabyte of RAM, 2+ million IOPS in a virtual machine, 10+ gigabits network connectivity to the VM, high availability to all of those, and we made that as a core table stakes. We support all of these with some of the core virtualization capabilities like LAMP migration and all the other availability constructs. We took advantage of the latest innovation in hardware, whether it's RDMA or AES NI offloads, or any kind of NIC offloads, SRIOV for networking, which enables you to carve up hardware and assign it to a virtual machine. Everything that's available in the hardware, we take advantage of, plus we keep driving innovation down the hardware path as well.
Okay, so you mentioned availability there, and mission-critical apps,
yes,
most of the time, require that highest level of almost continuous availability.
Yes.
How do we deliver that at the fabric layer, the host layer, if you will? But in addition, if you've got workloads inside virtual machines that require their own level of availability, i.e. perhaps a SQL Server cluster or an Oracle-related cluster, whatever, what are some of the innovation we've built into the platform that enables organizations to benefit there?
Great. So in the guest, we have introduced some new capabilities called shared VHDX that enable virtual machines to be clustered themselves. So we group virtual machines. These virtual machines can be spread across multiple hosts, and you can create clustering inside there to take advantage of availability or shared storage inside virtual machines. Applications or workloads like SQL can take advantage of that natively, or rather virtually, directly inside a virtual machine. Now, the same capabilities are also available on the host side, where we take advantage of storage replication and automatic failover, whether it's shared nothing live migration. We have all those capabilities on the host side to ensure that your workload never comes down. In fact, we went a step further when we talk about how do we bring these innovations rapidly to our customers. So anytime we have to introduce a new capability with a new upgrade to the infrastructure, we start worrying about what about the workloads? How do we make sure that the workloads don't incur a downtime? And that's where we actually introduced a capability called zero downtime upgrade of the infrastructure SKU itself or of the host infrastructure. And with that, what we allow you to do is have mixed mode clusters. So I have the slide which talks about that in a simplistic manner, which says you can have an existing cluster that can be upgraded to the latest version of Windows Server, and it will be a seamless automated process where you can upgrade each and every host, and the VMs will be automatically migrated back and forth to ensure that there is zero downtime to the workload. And this is just one example of how we take that very seriously. We really want to maintain the SLA. We want the hosters to maintain their SLAs to their tenants where workloads never go down, even if it's for an upgrade.
Right. So what you had on the slide there, and if we take another look, you've got a cluster initially consisting of Windows Server 2012 R2 with Hyper-V, and you've got a number of virtual machines over there, and you've moved the VMs Correct. Off one of the nodes. You've evicted that spare node now from the existing cluster. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially, you've still got, let's call it cluster one that exists. You've evicted that node, so it's gone from a 3 node to a 2 node. And now what you're saying is we perform the upgrade on the spare node that's free.
Correct.
And then add it back in? Is that what the process looks
like? Correct, yes. So let me walk you through it. So it's a phased approach. So you have this 3 node cluster and you see the animation of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So the first step, as you correctly pointed out, is that we take the VMs running on that host and migrate it off on the remaining host. Then you upgrade that particular host and you add it back to the cluster. And now the cluster is really in a mixed mode. It's in a mixed mode environment.
Okay.
Where some of your hosts are on the old Windows Server 2012 R2 host, and the other hosts are the vNext version host. But as you noticed, as it was shown in the slide, you could migrate the virtual machines back and forth.
Right.
And then you take one host at a time and upgrade it. All the while, your virtual machines are always up, your workload is always up, and you are not incurring a downtime.
Okay, so you're at a point where you've gone through a phase of having a single cluster with mixed 2012 R2 and vNext operating systems on the host. You get to the stage where you finally migrated everything across and everything is running still on cluster one that we used
Yes.
before, but now all of those nodes are running the vNext version.
Correct.
Is there anything we need to do to finalize that process to light up the new features of the next release in the cluster?
Absolutely. So some of the features would get automatically lit up as you get onto the new host. There are some capabilities that you'll just get just because you are on a new host.
Okay.
But there are a host of capabilities, specifically VM capabilities, that get lit up inside the virtual machine only if the cluster itself has been deemed as, hey, you have been upgraded. And that's a specific step that the customers have to do to conclude that exercise of, yep, my cluster is now updated and it's on the vNext host
right.
or vNext version. That's also a point in time where you are making the stance that I'm no longer going to go back. Mm-hmm. So essentially, let's start using new capabilities in the vNext host.
Right. So you could be running essentially vNext hosts in a 2012 R2 cluster.
Yes.
You could still go back to the previous hosts unless you run this PowerShell command and then you've upgraded the cluster, you've finalized the process.
Correct.
Okay, great. Correct. So that's a great example of where you can move to the next version of the platform and while still keeping your workloads online and up and running. Now, traditionally, there's a couple of ways of deploying Windows Server. There's, if you've used the DVD, you'll know that you can deploy with the GUI version of Windows Server. There's also a Server Core installation option as well. And with more recent releases of Windows Server, you can enable and disable the UI as well, very flexibly. However, tell me about some new innovation that's coming in the next release of the platform that's going to change things again.
So let me introduce NanoServer. You probably have heard about it in the keynote. NanoServer is the next evolution of Windows Server. You can say that that's the future of Windows Server. With NanoServer, we went, you can say, multiple steps ahead of what Server Core could have done. We have reduced the footprint significantly, thus reducing the patching required to maintain this. NanoServer is your the just enough operating system for your host infrastructure. It's also your server for your next generation of applications. It's small, it's lightweight, it's everything that we wanted Windows Server, and we have finally delivered that.
So when we say it's small, it's minimal, what does that mean for key things like patching and security and deployment times, but also what do you envisage, at least at this stage, some of the core roles, if we think in the traditional Windows Server sense, that people would enable on this? So for instance, is it going to be an ideal Hyper-V host? Is it going to be a file server? What kind of things can you think about there, patching, security, and roles?
Absolutely. So the way to think about NanoServer is, unlike the past where Windows Server was a large monolithic server with all the roles and all the bits pre-packaged, NanoServer is a core component of the smallest operating system with just the core kernel components, enough to act as a starting point. And from that point on, you can convert NanoServer to whatever you want it to be. You install the drivers, just the drivers that's needed to run on your hardware. You turn on or you add packages to it to make it just be a Hyper-V host. Or you can add packages to it that makes it look like a file server. Or in fact, you could add components to it that make it look like an application runtime. So an ASP.next, vNext package that you can apply to it and it becomes your runtime environment for your application. So in all of these cases, what you have is an OS that's purpose-built for the purpose you're building it for the purpose of deployment. So in the case of infrastructure, you would have the NanoServer being configured to just be a Hyper-V host with nothing other than clustering turned on. You have another one with file server and clustering acting as your storage node, and another one with just the AD service running on it. And each of them have just the bits that's needed to run that particular thing. By doing this, what we have enabled is to reduce the patching cycle, to reduce the criticality of fixes that needs to be applied, reduce the need of how often those systems have to be patched. And that's been the biggest thing where we go after that.
And I'm guessing also things like deployment time. If you choose to deploy Nano inside a VM or even on a physical server, I'm guessing it's pretty rapid.
Yes, it's going to be significantly less time than our existing server core and server full images. The image size is expected to be really small. I don't want to share any numbers yet. But you will get those details as you progress. But it also depends on the packages that you add to it and how you define what NanoServer is. At the core of it, you only have things like PowerShell and the kernel to manage it, and that's pretty much it.
Okay, cool. So hopefully that's interesting. Certainly, when I've been talking with customers, they've always discussed that desire of having the smallest footprint they can, and this is one way certainly that we're delivering on that. So if we change direction slightly now and go back to what our three challenges were, we mentioned mission-critical apps. Let's think about security again. So how can I secure my environment? NanoServer actually does fit into this conversation because it's so small, reduced attack surface. But what are some of the real tangible examples now of features and capabilities that we're bringing into the products that enable that customer to secure that environment? So why don't you walk us through that?
Sure. So let me start with a premise that security from a NanoServer point of view is prevention, and that's always a great thing. We are always aspiring to ensure that we don't get attacked. But what we are doing with our Protect the Virtual Machines and this new promise that we're making is we just have to assume that there is a breach. And the breach need not be from people hacking into us or attacking from external, but it could be from within. So it could be one of the virtualization administrators who, for whatever reason, has gone rogue and would like to tamper and attack and steal secrets from the VMs. And that's really the scary thing. To protect against that is being the biggest promise that or the biggest problem that we are trying to solve. And we have, in fact, by offering such capabilities through the platform itself. And so if I look at the slide, you can argue that there are roughly three things that we talk about. a person who has access, complete physical access to the machine, how do we prevent that virtual machine from running on it? And that's where we use hardware router technologies to ensure that if the machine has not been deemed as one of a secure known entity, then no one should be able to get into that machine and steal some secrets. So we have a new environment called the virtual secure mode that's been added to Windows and Windows kernel. That's hypervisor-backed environment that will protect secrets even from kernel mode components running inside Windows. So that's the root of where we start our security promise from. A very secure environment within Windows where we can store secrets that no one can get to it. The next one, if you look at the slide, would be the fabric, the guarded fabric or the guardian fabric that can ensure that when you have machines in my environment, which machines have been deemed as my machines as opposed to something that a rogue administrator can bring in and connect. So if I have a data center with, say, 100 hosts, I should be able to manifest each of the, or create a manifest of each of them and know exactly which of those 100 machines are. And the Guardian service helps me with inventorying and protecting those machines. This prevents somebody from coming in with a laptop, plugging it into my network and say, and claiming that they are secure and part of the data center. So the Guardian fabric ensures that only the right machines are considered part of this thing. And the third thing is how do we provide this information to the tenant so the tenant can take advantage of it? And the mechanism we are using is the virtual TPM. And exposing the TPM into the virtual machine enables tenants to now start protecting and encrypting their data using existing tools. So TPM is nothing new in the physical world. People have been using it on your laptops. You have been bitlocking your VMs. The same mechanism is now available on the server within a virtual machine, all bound to the fabric, the guarded fabric, and connected to the VSM, all the way tied to the physical virtualization host to ensure that when a tenant decides to encrypt the data inside the virtual machine, they know that that VM will only start up on these machines, on these deemed machines, or the machines deemed by the hoster. So that, the end-to-end, which is what we create, a shielded VM, is a powerful promise that we are enabling with vNext.
So you're saying here that these three key areas of protecting virtual machines, do you find or will you find that people tend to use all three, or can they be used in isolation?
So now that's an interesting debate that's going on within Microsoft. On one hand, to make the promise that I started off with, which says that the administrator, that the employee of the hoster who is an admin on the box should not be able to get into the tenant's data. If that's the highest level of promise that we aspire towards and a tenant decides and demands that, then yes, we need all three. But then there are other aspects of it where if it's my private environment, if I as a customer is willing to create a private environment where I do trust my virtualization administrator, but I still need some level of guarantee and protection, essentially data protection at rest, then I don't need to build all those these three capabilities. Just a virtual TPM available inside a virtual machine is good enough, and we will enable those things as well.
So that might enable somebody to satisfy a compliance request, for instance, if they have to have an encrypted OS, and in virtual world, that's not been possible up to now, and now, yeah.
It'll Correct.
There you go. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So that's a little bit about security, and combined with platform investments we're making in things like Nano, really delivering and enabling you to protect your infrastructure in a more efficient way. But these are great capabilities, but how will I implement them? Will I use Inbox Windows Server, or will I be using System Center Management to control all of this these security features?
Yes and yes. So the ultimate or the best experience that you get with Windows Server, with Hyper-V Windows Server, and all the components we have built is by using System Center. And the complete orchestration is possible through System Center. We're introducing a couple of new capabilities with the Guardian service. We need to be able to lay those bits down. We need to make sure that it's all configured and orchestrated properly. System Center has been designed and to ensure that the buildup of these guarded fabric starts from ground up. It starts from when you order the machines from one of your favorite OEMs and the machines are delivered. System Center takes over from that point of view, ensures that the right image is installed on it, and it boots up and it configures the fabric and the guarded fabric to ensure that the service considers these hosts as part of their environment. The System Center also orchestrates the whole notion of how do you create templates and shield secure templates through which we can create these shielded VMs. So the end-to-end orchestration is being provided by System Center, and while it might be possible for someone to hand manage all of this because all the APIs are public APIs, the general guidance that we have is for the best experience, it's System Center plus Windows Server that provides you the best end-to-end out-of-the-box experience.
Okay. So we've talked quite a bit about security there, and ultimately what you're protecting is you're protecting your data, but you're also protecting, ultimately, the stuff that's inside your VMs, which will be your applications. And when we think about earlier when we mentioned supporting new types of applications, you gave us a couple of examples of new cloud-like applications, but what about traditional apps? What about for organizations that are running Linux on Hyper-V? Could you tell us a little bit about the investments we're making to make sure that Linux runs really well on Hyper-V as a platform?
Oh, absolutely. So we have, it was a few years back when we realized that getting Linux running very well on Hyper-V-based systems is of paramount importance. Our first step was to ensure that we work closely with the open source community, and you can tell it was not easy for Microsoft to be considered an open source partner, but we worked through those issues. We have one of the best engagements with open source at this point with our ICs, ensuring that Linux and other non-Windows variants can run very well on Hyper-V. It's an ongoing investment, so we started by saying, do we have feature parity? Do we get all the capabilities that we have available on Windows to be made available on Linux? So that's starting point one. The next step is to ensure that do we have performance and scale parity, both for Azure and for on-prem environments? And it's an ongoing thing. So while we believe we are very close in terms of what our competitors offer, we are not satisfied. So we want to keep pushing the bar to ensure that any investment that we make in ensuring Windows VMs run best on Hyper-V, we put equal effort to ensure that Linux VMs runs equally well on Hyper-V. So we don't want to have an environment where customers have to choose a different virtualization platform just because their workload or the guest operating system happens to be non-Windows.
Okay, so when we think about Linux, there's a lot of discussion out there on the web around these new kind of cloud applications, and one term that gets often bandied around is the use of containers. It's been talked about in the Linux context, but as we saw in the keynote, we're starting to see containers come into the Microsoft platform. So tell us, I know you're excited about that, it's exciting for our developers and for our IT ops as well. Tell us about where containers fits in the Microsoft story, in the data center.
So there are actually two things I want to talk about when I talk about containers. There are actually very interesting things. The first thing I want to call out is that this is an awesome example where while Microsoft has been dabbling in the space of containers for over a decade, we have not released a product with containers as such. The reason why we are doing it now is because we actually looked at the innovation that's happening in the open source and felt we need to adopt some of that. And the way we are doing it, and that's very exciting. This is the new Microsoft where we do our part and we embrace what's available out there. So we take the innovation that's already present and provide the best of the breed for our customers. So stepping back, yes, containers is a big thing and we have that capability and we will produce that capability as part of Windows Server vNext. In fact, we go beyond that by providing our own enterprise awareness into it. So when you look at Linux containers, it's been awesome. They have, actually, let me step back. It's not just containers. In fact, let me call out to Docker specifically of how they used containers and they created this packaging and deployment model that was very simple, but very useful for the developers that bridge the gap between developers and operations operations folks and ensure that you have a rapid iteration model. And that whole experience is what we want to bring to our Microsoft customers. And the way we decide to bring that to our Microsoft customers is by, first of all, bringing that core container capability into the Windows environment. So Windows Server has containers now. In fact, we went beyond and said, it's not just regular containers. We also have this ability to provide a much higher level of isolation that we believe our customers would want. The level of isolation as people have observed with virtual machines. So when you have containers running in Windows Server, we want it to have fast startup time, high density, but a level of isolation that's still controllable by the customer. With this, we also want to ensure that we are not reinventing the wheel. So we look at the open source community and see Docker as the front end. We also see there's a host of open source projects and other environments that's built on Docker, and we want to make sure that we bring all those goodness and make it available to our customers. Essentially bridge the gap between Linux development and Windows development. And so while we brought Windows Server containers to the market, we also brought it with Docker as the front end. So we have a port of Docker daemon running natively on Windows to enable you to have the same Docker CLI command line experience to manage Windows containers as it is to manage Linux containers. It will run seamlessly on-prem as it does in Azure. A lot of the open source projects that's built on top of it, like Mesos, will just run seamlessly with the Docker native API set. And that's essentially the promise that we are building, is bringing what is out there. We believe this is a huge step forward in terms of the new developer experience. And we want to make sure that our customers, the customers who build Microsoft applications, get to take advantage of it.
Okay, so that's a good overview of containers. When we think about the IT pro and the IT implementer out there, who's perhaps not as familiar with some of the development tools, frameworks, packaging mechanisms, and so on, they may be the infrastructure guys deploying the storage, networking, and compute. How is this different from a virtual machine?
So on one hand, what we have tried to do is try to make sure that the gap or the bridge from virtual machines to containers is as seamless as possible. But at the same time, people have to understand, or it's good to understand, where does it lie in the spectrum of the various deployment techniques and the runtime environments. So on one hand, you have processes, which are super lightweight workload running in a process in an operating system. On the other hand, you have an entire operating system containing the workload running in a virtual machine. Containers fall somewhere in the middle, where you can think of your application taking a dependency on a certain aspect of an operating system that gets packaged in a very lightweight manner, just the layer of what is needed to be packaged, and then deployed through a centralized mechanism. And this is what Docker provides, the Docker Hub and the Docker ability to package and deploy applications or workloads as container images, and then run it anywhere you want it. The API surface that we are building, so Microsoft, when we release our container technologies, will have the Docker API set. It will also have a native PowerShell experience that you will see matches very close to what you get with Hyper-V-based environments. And the purpose for doing that is to help you jumpstart your environment to ensure that you get the similar experience that you're familiar with, and it's not completely new for you to bring and learn. But containers do offer an interesting difference between virtual machines. So on one hand, you can argue that containers are shorter-lived environments and not long-lived environments like virtual machines. The key distinction in my mind between a container and a virtual machine is the life cycle. If you ever find that as deploying containers, you have to patch a container, then that means what you really need is a virtual machine. So a container is something that you should think of as a task-oriented environment that you start up, you scale out, you scale back. Some of it might be long-running, but the life cycle of it is that the state with which it's running inside the container is persisted outside of the container, not within the container. So you don't have to manage the life cycle of a container from within the container. It's all done outside.
Okay, so hopefully that gives you a little bit more insight into containers and how they're deployed, so integrating with Docker. So good partnerships there to really enable you to embrace container technology to deploy applications as efficiently as you can. When we think about some of the density, are we expecting that you could run more applications on a single machine with using containers than with virtual machines? And can I combine the two? Could I have containers inside virtual machines on a Hyper-V host? What are some of the architectural topologies?
Oh, great. So let me ask, so you asked two different questions. Let me answer them independently. The density of containers. One of the primary attributes of a container is that you have as much sharing as possible across the containers. So using that as the definition, we do believe that you will have better density and better startup times than virtual machines. Virtual machines, by definition, contain a whole operating system within the virtual machine. And with containers, we do more sharing. Now, having said that, it's just at the operating system level where you have the most of the sharing. Now, as you go into the application stack, and depending on how big your workload is, you might find that density would be depending on what you decide to run within the container. So if you choose to run, for whatever reason, and this is a hypothetical example, where if you have a super large SQL server, but you are choosing to run it as a container, you will still get the same level of density that you get with a virtual machine, which is maybe you will run one of those. Why would you choose to do that is a very different question. You probably might not. But on the other hand, for most simple workloads, you will typically find that running it in a virtual machine makes it heavier weight. If all you're doing is a simple Node.js script that's running a web service, listening to a port and providing back a static page, you should find significant advantage in terms of density when you're trying to pack a lot of those containers on a single machine. So that would be how you should look at it, saying where is the bulk of your resource consumption happening. If the resource consumption is happening in the workload, then the density would be fairly similar to virtual machines. But if the bulk of the resource consumption is happening in the operating system, then you should find a much higher density gain when you're using containers. Now to the other question that you asked, which is what's the deployment model? Is it a nested environment where containers run inside virtual machines, or do containers have to run physical? And the answer is you can do both. But nesting is definitely one of the more immediate options that people get to use. So when you are dealing with containers, you get to use containers on Azure virtual machines. In fact, it could be on any other virtual machine as long as it's available. It could be an AWS virtual machine, or it could be a VMware virtual machine, or a Hyper-V virtual machine. So from a container point of view, we don't distinguish between which virtualization platform it needs to run on. So containers can run natively on a physical and carve out resources, or it can be deployed within virtual machines.
Okay, great. Well, that brings us to the end of this particular session. Hopefully you found that useful. Again, we're focusing on the Microsoft Data Center vNext preview, where we're bringing Azure to your data center. And hopefully a number of examples we've given today have showcased how we're doing that. There's big innovation going into the platform to enable us to support mission critical applications, secure your infrastructure more efficiently and more granularly with some of the new capabilities, but also in addition, support the next generation of application, in particular containers. Now make sure you check out the rest of the videos as part of this series, and also check out some of the recordings on MVA to learn more about containers and other Windows Server technology. But with that, I'll thank Matthew for his time, and thanks for joining us.